Food prices have increased over 40%. Energy prices have increased over 20%. Wheat and gas prices have increased over 70%. What's going to be next? Do you see these trends reversing or even stabilizing? All fiat currencies have always failed and collapsed their economies on their way down. The Roman Empire, China, France, Argentina, Finland, Mexico, Russia, Zimbabwe all tried fiat currency and all collapsed into chaos. Meanwhile, the dollar has lost over 97% of its gold value since 1971, when an ounce of gold was valued at $35. If your assets are in paper, you are in danger. Protect your assets with gold and silver. Visit Discount Gold and Silver Trading at DGScoins.com. That's DGScoins.com or call 1-800-375-4188. That's 800-375-4188. Protect yourself and your family.
Good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen. You're listening to Financial Survival, brought to you by Discount Gold and Silver Trading. I'm Melody Cedarstrom. I'm here with my co-host, Dave Allen, bringing you our opinion and commentary on today's economic and political events for Tuesday, December 19th, 2023. Hi, Dave.
Hey, Melody. Happy National Hard Candy Day.
Yuck.
You know what that means, yes? Good day to be chomping on some good old candy canes. I read that the origin of candy canes date back to 1670 in Cologne, Germany. It was there in the Cologne Cathedral where the choirmaster wanted a remedy to stop the noise caused by all the children yakking during the living creche tradition of Christmas Eve. So he asked a local candy maker for some sugar sticks to give to them. Yes, sugar to quiet the kids down. It all started there, Melody. To justify the practice of giving candy to children during Mass, the choirmaster asked the candy maker to add a crook to the top of each stick, which would help children remember the shepherds who visited the baby Jesus. In addition, he used the original white color of the converted sticks to teach children about the Christian belief in the sinless life of their Savior. Centuries later, red and other colored stripes were added as the commercialization of Christmas entered the fray. And now you know.
I thought sugar wound kids up.
I can second that.
Although back in those days, I'm sure they didn't have as much sugar as the children do today. So that was probably a really big treat. That was probably, as poor and I bet it was, very interesting. Thank you.
Hey.
Thank you.
What we're here for, to educate.
I like that one. Well, let's go ahead and see what gold has done today. Gold was up $13 today at $2,053. Silver was up 24 pennies at $24.35. Platinum was up 8 at 962. Palladium was up 37, 1,236. And that's all based. Palladium's only roaring based on, 3 to 4 interest rate cuts next year and business booming. So let's get there first. But hey. The Dow was up more than 200 points, the ninth winning day, 251 points, 37,557. The S&P was up. And you know what, that 251, it's still just a little over 0.5%. The S&P was up 27, points, and the NASDAQ was up 98 points, less again, well, less than 0.75%. So you have Europe, they were all positive. Asia, Hang Seng was lower, still less. Everything is less than 1%. 10-year yield, that was lower, 3.93 for the 10-year yield. Natural gas was stronger, 0.5%, holding at 2.55. So that is pretty much, I didn't do oil. I did natural gas. Oil was up $1, a little over $1 at 73.58. And I think that is just about it, Dave, for the metals and the paper markets. And so we're going to move on, should we?
Sure.
You know, before the program, we were talking about how cold we all are. And with my wind chill factor, guess what? I won 32 degrees. It's the cold one here. We talked about these storms yesterday. And the what about the insurance? I mean, the insurance industry premiums already are up over 19% this year. And utility crews with the storm were working to restore power to hundreds of thousands of customers in Maine. Some rivers continue to rise following the powerful storm. And we had wind speeds over 60 miles per hour in some areas, and at least 5 people were killed. Many communities were saturated, with some getting well over 3 inches of rain during this storm. There's parts of Maryland who had 4 and 5 inches of rain. I think we got close to 4. We had a lot. It's just like, ugh. But some towns in Vermont, which had suffered major flooding from a storm in July, they were seeing some more flood damage. A lot of those school districts remain closed today. In Jersey, and in some parts of Pennsylvania, the northeastern part, they had more than 5 inches of rain. And as I mentioned, some states like mine got, in Maryland, got to 4+ inches of rain. So it was quite a storm, and we're still getting the wind. We're still having strong winds today. So
yeah, it's blowing like crazy here in southeastern Pennsylvania today. Pretty wild up in New England. I mean, you got the Androscoggin River in Maine reached a maximum stage of 22 feet in a 24-hour period. The flood stage begins at 15 feet, so it was over 7 feet above flood stage. And in Vermont, where a good part of the region got hammered in July, they're currently experiencing flooding again. So for them, it's July revisited, and their governor, Phil Scott, says it's a real gut punch. But the good news is up there anyway. It certainly isn't in the mid-Atlantic, but up New England, it's into the high 50s and low 60s, surprisingly. And the 5 people that Melody mentioned were killed. It looks like most of them were in vehicles that got swept away. In Catskill, New York, a vehicle went around a barricade on a flooded road and was swept into the Catskill Creek. He drowned. Man pronounced dead in my neighboring Lancaster County after he was found in a submerged vehicle last night. So, ladies and gentlemen, once again, be safe out there.
And, you know, just it's cold, and it's not something we talk about a lot, but black ice. When I was traveling last week, it was drier than a bone out there. I mean, there was just no rain whatsoever. The sun was out. It was early in the morning, and there was just a little patch of black ice on the side of the road, And luckily, my four tiles, you know, it was small enough that your four tires didn't hit it. And but it certainly gave my car a little bit of a twisty going through it for the. So be careful out there. So even though you can't see the danger can be there, especially with the black ice. I dislike black ice very much. There's nothing you can do when you're on it. I mean, my brakes locked up, and it was just a short little, you know, skid and so forth. But it's very uncomfortable, and because you have no control. So, as Dave said, be safe out there. It's winter time, and single family home building that surged more than a year and a half in November, and of course, declining mortgage rates, a lot of incentives from builders. Trying to get people back into the housing market. We saw that the you know, when mortgage rates were jumping over 7 and 8 briefly for the 8%, new construction activity just kind of dropped. The new housing market remains by an acute shortage of previously owned homes that are available for sale. Economists raised their fourth quarter GDP growth estimates and predicted that the housing market would help the economy avoid a recession next year. Of course, they're bringing out everything possible to avoid that recession next year. It just cracks me up. Long-term interest rates fall. Builders will add more supply to the housing markets to meet that demand, fueling economic growth. Single-family housing starts, which account for the bulk of the home building, jumped 18% to a seasonally adjusted annual rate of 1.14 million units last month. And that was all according to the Census Bureau. And that was the highest level since April of last year. So it certainly has been a long time to see any type of growth in that, Dave.
Yeah, well, the rate on the 30-year fixed mortgage is down from 7.03 to 6.95 last week. That's good news. Of course, still not close to the high twos and low threes we saw a couple years ago. But building permits for future construction of single-family homes increased about 0.75%. At a pace of about 976,000 units. Again, the highest in a year and a half. That they say bodes well for residential investment. We will see. I mean, the housing industry has been mired in a recession, mild to a deep recession, for many, many months, over a year. I mean, first it was the lack of supply and inventory, and, you know, early on in the pandemic, it was, you know, lumber prices, and then interest rates and mortgage rates went through the roof. So certainly this is a trend in the right direction, although I would hesitate to call the numbers optimistic unless we see, you know, a continued rise in these numbers for at least another quarter, Melody. We will see overall housing starts soared 15% in November to a rate of over, well, call it 1.56 million units. So a little bit of good news for an industry that's been struggling.
Yeah, it's struggling is certainly a nice word for it. I mean, it's just been it's been hammered. But, you know, and then you got to look at the multiplier. No new homes, no new appliances, no new this, no new that, no new carpet, no new, you know, furniture. So there is certainly that. That is the domino effect, but it just doesn't seem to matter. I mean, heck, yeah, nothing matters, you know. And the you know,
Melody, you matter.
You do too, Dave.
Discount Gold and Silver Trading matters,
and so does Cousin Todd.
There you go. Anyway.
But inflation, you know, households are, of course, they're still feeling squeezed because inflation hasn't gone away and has come down, but then we're still paying the same price. if not more, in some areas. And so when you say that the inflation has eased over the past year, well, yeah, this month it's easier. It's lower than what it was last year, but you're still paying last year's prices in most areas. Not maybe not all, but in a lot. The number of households stretched thin, that has barely budged. As of November, 62% of adults said they're living paycheck to paycheck. This was according to a Lending Club report, and that was pretty much unchanged from a year ago. But hey, those consumers out there, holiday spending from November 1st through December 1st is expected to increase between 3 and 4% over last year to a record total of $957 billion, almost $1 trillion. Even as credit card debt tops $1 trillion, almost all, or 96% of shoppers said they expect to overspend this season. So yeah, go deeper and deeper in debt, ladies and gentlemen. See how you're going to get out of that. Half of consumers plan to take on more debt to cover those holiday expenses. And of course, we already know that there's still people paying from last year's holiday expenses. Only 23% have a plan to pay it off within 1 or 2 months. So, you know, people are just not sticking to a budget. Doesn't even seem like they have one. But I don't know, Dave.
Well, I mean, to make matters worse, I mean, if they're not using credit cards, they're more and more using the buy now, pay later. But as we talked about a couple of months ago, if you do go down that road, just make sure you pay on time, or you're going to be paying some significant late fees and finance charges. But the best thing is all of us, virtually all of us, work on a cash basis. Two-thirds of us live paycheck to paycheck. Why make it more difficult by going into debt, especially debt that can't be paid off every month? That's where you really get hammered now, with average interest rates well over 15% and some over 30 now. You're just asking for trouble. Now, interestingly, another survey, cardholders who carry a balance from month to month in their credit cards are also more likely to feel financial distress. Not surprising. 74% of Americans say they're stressed about finances, according to a separate CNBC survey. Inflation, rising interest rates, and a lack of savings contribute feelings. Again, survey found, I mean, it depends on who you're talking to. I've seen there's 61% in this survey. There's 62% in another one of Americans living paycheck to paycheck. Either way, it's a lot and it's too much. I'll talk more about inflation in today's third segment.
Well, you know, U.S. steel shares, they surged yesterday after Japan-based Nippon Steel announced plans to purchase the once iconic American producer. The value, the deal is based on, $14.9 billion, to be exact. And that's pretty much double what the U.S. rival Cleveland Cliffs had offered for the company just 4 months ago.
Hey.
The stock was in negative territory for the year until this past August, when the Cleveland Cliffs made a splashy bid to merge, and it's now sitting on gains of about 100%. But the U.S. Steel was founded in 1901. It was a 20th century industrial giant. And, you know, it remained the largest steel maker. Wasn't it pretty much the only one?
Yeah, really.
In the country as recently as 2014. I guess it is the third largest steel maker in the U.S. behind Nucor and, of course, Cleveland Cliffs. The U.S. market is a bright spot for the global steel industry. It's been somewhat sheltered, though, from the cheaper Chinese exports. So, but we had tariffs imposed by the Trump administration on Chinese steel imports on national security grounds. And this administration did leave those tariffs in place. The tariffs have contributed to what Fitch analysts recently described as the exceptional profitability of the U.S. market, Dave. Oh.
That was a good ending. Good timing.
Yes, how about that? We'll be right back, ladies and gentlemen.
In the lane, snow is glistening. A beautiful sight. We're happy tonight. Walking in a winter wonderland. Gone away is the bluebird. Here to stay is a new bird. He sings a love song as we go along. Walking in a winter wonderland.
Since the beginning of the United States, kings have sought it, nations have fought for it. It has been traded, borrowed, purchased, and stolen. There is a reason for it. To secure the blessings of liberty to ourselves and our posterity, invest with the security of gold and silver. Call Discount Gold and Silver Trading at 1-800-375-4188. That's 1-800-375-4188. Listen to Financial Survival with your host, Melody Cederstrom, on Shortwave Radio. Visit DiscountGoldAndSilverTrading.net or call 1-800-375-4188. That's 1-800-375-4188. For the very best in gold and silver trading, call toll-free 1-800-375-4188. That's 1-800-375-4188. Call now.
Melody Cederstrom and CSE Talk Radio team up as Common Sense Voices of Integrity. I personally endorse Melody Cederstrom to be your trusted go-to expert for all your precious metal needs. Experts agree a financial crisis and even collapse is inevitable. Given our government's lack of economic leadership and self-interests of those in power, it's no longer a question of if you should purchase gold and silver, but if you will purchase gold and silver before it's too late. Melody encourages you to tune in each weekday morning. Visit CSETalkRadio.com. We both agree truth and education are the two significant factors in both our missions. There is a wealth of misinformation out there. Let Melody and Beth Ann help you sort through the chaos and bring you home to the truths that will ensure that you and your family are protected. Call Discount Gold and Silver Trading 1-800-375-4188 or online at dgscoins.com. Melody and Beth Ann are strong forces together working to preserve liberty and bring America home.
Here comes Santa Claus, here comes Santa Claus, right down Santa Claus Lane. Blixin' and blixin' and all his reindeers pulling on the reins. Bells are ringing, children singing, all is merry and bright. So hang your stockings and say your prayers, 'cause Santa Claus comes tonight. Come Santa Claus, here comes Santa Claus, right down Santa Claus Lane.
And here comes Santa Claus, 1-800-375-4188. That's 1-800-375-4188. Now, that's not for Santa Claus. That's for Discount Gold and Silver Trading. Give us a call at 1-800-375-4188. Make sure you visit our website at dgscoins.com, dgscoins.com. We were just finishing up the U.S. steel bid, and I wonder if Japan has to recognize unions. Do you think they would have to, Dave?
I don't know, but I mean, this is a privately owned Japanese company. Not owned in whole or in part by the country itself, and if they're operating here, they'd have to comply with U.S. law. So you know that means labor laws as well. So my take on it is the answer to that would be yes.
You would hope so.
Yeah.
You kind of lost you there for a minute, so let's go ahead.
Sorry.
Yeah, let's go ahead and talk about the interest rates again. And, you know, high interest rates are hurting, you know, some of the poorest nations. But, I mean, they've got historic debt burden. One of the lagged effects of the worldwide tightening campaign, the aftermath is still being felt across these low-income countries as the global interest rates soar, making it more expensive to pay off debt and drawing parallels to the crisis of the 80s. The longer that interest rate stays high, the more likely they're going to get in trouble, the world chief economist Indermitt Gill said last week. But also, yes, their debt, but also our strength in the dollar, which weakens their currency, has also put a big damper. So I'm not sure which is, because that way they can't pay off their debt. Their debt becomes more, it takes more to service it, I think. Is that correct, Dave?
Yeah.
So over the past 3 years, there were 18 sovereign defaults where a nation failed to make a payment across 10 developing countries. That's more than the total of the previous two decades combined. Historic borrowing during the era of rock bottom rates, particularly during the pandemic, is now starting to hit home. One of the list of defaults, Guyana, Zambia, Sri Lanka. Next is likely Ethiopia, whose finance minister said last week that it was set to miss the 14-day grace period for an interest payment due this month, Dave.
Yeah, that's not good. Now, excluding China, external debt as a share of gross national income among these low to middle income nations actually fell by about 4 percentage points last year. A decline that came solely, they say, because of a stronger U.S. dollar. But the ratio remains historically high. In 2022, for example, it was 33%. Up 6 percentage points from the prior decade. But for the poorest nations, it's more bleak. External debt rose to 46% of gross national income, up from 29% 10 years earlier. That's not good. Economist Nicole Golden at the Atlanta Council says that many countries are forced to divert spending from education, health, or infrastructure in the poorest countries to service debt, even as financing becomes less available and more expensive. And of course, that's undermining growth and ultimately impacting those already facing economic insecurity. So it ain't too good for these smaller countries. For the first time since 2015, Melody, private creditors withdrew more funds than they put into developing nations.
And very few people report on that. Just, you know, hey, it doesn't seem to make a difference. If they default, they default, right?
Right.
It's just puzzling. Last Thursday, an insurance brokerage called USI borrowed $600 million from investors in the high-yield bond market. It reportedly Wall Street's first bond deal with a CCC, triple C credit rating, since all the way back in April. Now, the triple C designation is the worst and riskiest. Say that three times. And the market for these bonds have been effectively dead. USI's offering is one of the many signals that the overall market's latest upswing has created an opening for companies to refinance debt that's coming due soon. Now, that's key because a wall of maturities looms over the next few years. And as the rates soared earlier this year, refinancing, you know, it hurt. It wasn't attractive. So it is the everything rally after all, maybe? The S&P 500 is surging. Treasury yields are in free fall since the Fed last signaled possible rate cuts in 2024. And, of course, everyone is expecting 3 to 4. In the multi-trillion dollar U.S. corporate bond, the moves are just as monumental. And it means that all of a sudden companies can borrow at much lower costs than they could just a few months ago. You know what, yeah. Dave? I just look at it this way. If they really want a 3 to 4 cuts in the interest rates, that means they're expecting not a soft landing next year, right? They're saying they need it. But anyway, that's my
opinion.
Well,
no, that's an interesting point. I was just thinking about that. What other factors are at play there? But no, that's a distinct possibility, certainly one explanation. I mean, we know the average yield on these CCC bonds dropped by almost a full percentage point last week alone. And yields in this market are at their lowest since August of last year. Now, it's not just the rickiest segment of the market, which is always more prone to large swings. The same trend goes for the rest of the high-yield bond market, too. And even in the more sober investment-grade bond market, where the biggest and most creditworthy companies borrow, yields dove by nearly half a percentage point just between last Monday and Thursday. So right now, the market appears to be open to some of these CCC deals because of what happened with the Fed pivoting and the market's subsequent rally. Megan Robeson at BNP Paribas, is that how you pronounce that? Paribas? Said it's a great time for companies to try to go take advantage of very positive sentiment and lower yields. But right as the market seems to be heating up, it's going to be shutting down because no one brings deals virtually of any kind during the last 2 weeks of December. But apparently there's a huge queue building of companies, especially in the investment grade area, that plans to launch new deals first thing after the first of the year. We'll see what happens.
You know, when they're going after all of this high risk rewards, good luck. Good luck. I was reading yesterday a lot of these retirement accounts, pensions, state and local pensions are going into riskier investments just to get the return on it. That's how bad they need the money to keep them flowing is the way I read it. It's not that it's a great deal. Why? I mean, if you're doing well in something that's a little more conservative and you don't have to take those risks, but they must foresee something coming that they need taking those chances.
Yeah, I mean, it could be. I mean, I read something, 6 months ago, I think, that this was more state and local government pensions, but I can see the same holding true for some corporate pension funds, those that are still around, that based on their different actuarial models and assumptions and what they have to meet to make up for lost time, on the one hand, lost ground, I should say, during a down year, and to start planning for the baby boomers retiring, which is going to raise the cost of their pension plans, that they're beginning to take on more risks to try and get better returns. I mean, more risk does not necessarily mean more reward. I hope these plans are well diversified. I would bet though. I mean, very, very few of them have gold and silver, for example, in their portfolios, and probably exclusively, you know, stock, bond, maybe a little bit real estate.
And we know most of these, you know, even if they're state and locals and so forth, they're all underfunded anyway. So they must be really underfunded now.
Well, that's
you know, the only one that I know is really funded is the U.S. Post Office, and they're going in debt by doing so because they're required to make sure they carry enough money there and so forth. But anyway, U.S. ports, they're receiving multi-million dollar grants, not loans, grants, to upgrade cargo handling infrastructure. The grants are part of the Biden administration's $21 billion commitment to modernize port infrastructure in the U.S. I don't understand why the cargo ships give money to upgrade the cargo handling infrastructure. Why do the U.S. taxpayers have to do it? Mid-sized port cities such as Baltimore among the 2023 grant recipients. In November, the Port of Baltimore received a $47 million grant to kickstart an offshore wind manufacturing hub, among other improvements. Yeah, and everybody's screaming about those offshore wind manufacturing hubs. For example, the funds will pay for a new berth or dock for rolling cargo. Baltimore is the top U.S. destination for rolling cargo imports. Did not know that. That's a category including, farm machinery from John Deere and light-duty vehicles from BMW, according to the Maryland Port Administration. More than $653 million in Port Infrastructure Development Program grants were awarded to the U.S. ports in 2023 by the U.S. Department of Transportation Maritime Administration. So, other projects receiving federal funds include $54 million for the Port of Tacoma, Husky Terminal expansion in Washington, and $52 million for the North Harbor Transportation System Improvement Project in Long Beach, California, Dave.
Yeah, I mean, Baltimore isn't the only city with a growing port, according to these maritime economists. The experts say gateways along the U.S. southeast coast are moving more cargo as major points of entry clog up with truck traffic. The company Ports America formed a public-private partnership with the state of Maryland to manage equipment and operations in sections of the Port of Baltimore. The group said that $550 million in upgrades have gone into Seagirt Marine Terminal alone for densification of the container yard. Since the partnership began way back in 2010. Now, they say these upgrades build on past plans to revive America's declining industrial cities. Perhaps a trade-off for all the manufacturing that's been lost over the years. In Baltimore, public officials are addressing bottlenecks along the supply chain beyond the port. They got this Howard Street Tunnel expansion project that they say will increase double-stacked rail capacity out of Baltimore, too, which could help companies working at the port move more goods to and from points in the Midwest.
Well, you know, we see these global shipping giants, how they're rerouting their vessels away from the Red Sea. As we see the conflict related to the Hamas-Israel war, you know, continue to spread, about 12%. Global trade depends on the Suez Canal, which connects the Red and the Mediterranean seas and serves as a shortcut for goods to move between Asia and Europe. But in response to the war, Yemen, Iran-backed Houthi rebels have been attacking merchant ships in the Red Sea before or after they move through the canal. The Mediterranean Shipping Company, which is the world's largest container line, as well as Maersk, Hapag-Lloyd, CMA, CGM, and Equinor, have all announced similar decisions over the past several days. BP is going to follow suit. I think they did today.
Yeah, now ships that would previously have used the Suez will have to travel around Africa's southern tip, extending trips from 6 to 14 days. That's according to a Secretary General of this trade group, International Chamber of Shipping. Bloomberg News says the disruption, along with the drought-induced delays in the Panama Canal, is now threatening to, quote, squelch a recovery in global trade and boost transportation costs, just as inflation is cooling across the world. Now, the attacks add pressure for U.S. military response. Yesterday, Secretary of Defense Lloyd Austin announced the establishment of a revamped maritime task force that will escort ships in the Red Sea and try to deter additional Houthi attacks. That's going to be somewhat unsettling for these private shipping companies. I'm just surprised that more of them haven't, I don't know, maybe it's, I'm sure it's a money thing, haven't hired
their own
security companies.
Yeah, their own instead of the U.S.
Maybe they're all in, who knows, in other parts of the world fighting wars.
Well, you can't forget about how the Saudis were in there fighting the Yemens. We'll be right back. Please stay tuned.
All the way home I'll be warm. Oh, the fire is slowly dying. And my dear, we're still goodbye. But as long as you love me so, let it snow, let it snow, let it snow.
Since the beginning of the United States, kings have sought it, nations have fought for it. It has been traded, borrowed, purchased, and stolen. There is a reason for it. To secure the blessings of liberty to ourselves and our posterity, invest with the security of gold and silver. Call Discount Gold and Silver Trading at 1-800-375-4188. That's 1-800-375-4188. Listen to Financial Survival with your host, Melody Cederstrom, on Shortwave Radio. Visit discountgoldandsilvertrading.net or call 1-800-375-4188. That's 1-800-375-4188. For the very best in gold and silver trading, call toll-free 1-800-375-4188. That's 1-800-375-4188. Call now.
Melody Cederstrom and CSE Talk Radio team up as Common Sense Voices of Integrity. I personally endorse Melody Cederstrom to be your trusted go-to expert for all your precious metal needs. Experts agree a financial crisis and even collapse is inevitable. Given our government's lack of economic leadership and self-interest of those in power, it's no longer a question of if you should purchase gold and silver, but if you will purchase gold and silver before it's too late. Melody encourages you to tune in each weekday morning. Visit CSETalkRadio.com. We both agree truth and education are the two significant factors in both our missions. There is a wealth of misinformation out there. Let Melody and Beth Ann help you sort through the chaos and bring you home to the truths that will ensure that you and your family are protected. Call Discount Gold and Silver Trading 1-800-375-4188 or online at dgscoins.com. Melody and Beth Ann are strong forces together working to preserve liberty and bring America home.
Through the years we all will be together, if the fates allow. Hang a shining star upon the highest bough, and have yourself a merry little Christmas.
Oh, that's lovely. And welcome back to Financial Survival. As you can tell, this is Dave Allen, Melody Taking Care of Other Client Business, this final segment. You know where she's at, 1-800-375-4188. Bear with my voice the last segment as I try and hold on. Hey, the Biden administration has singled another crackdown on corporate America, but regulators' teeth seem to be smaller and blunter in the U.S. than, say, across the big pond. For all of U.S. regulators' bluster on regulating AI and big tech, a lot more is getting done in Europe and the U.K., and it's likely to remain that way for the foreseeable future. The U.S. Department of Justice welcomed yesterday's announcement that Adobe was calling off its highly controversial merger with Figma, but the death blow was dealt by antitrust regulators, not here, but in the EU and UK. Similarly, the terms of Microsoft's acquisition of Activision were dictated by UK authorities, and The first real AI rules of the road will come from the EU. As we mentioned last week, the EU's Artificial Intelligence Act is the latest set of regulations designed to govern technology in Europe that's destined to have a worldwide impact. The AI Act takes what's called a risk-based approach to products or services that use artificial intelligence and focus on regulating uses of AI rather than the technology itself. They say the legislation is designed to protect democracy, the rule of law, and fundamental rights like freedom of speech, while still encouraging investment and innovation. And the riskier an AI application is under the EU rules, the stiffer they are. Some AI uses are simply banned because they're deemed to pose an unacceptable risk, like social scoring systems that govern how people behave. Also, some types of predictive policing and emotion recognition systems in schools and workplaces. Now, people in public can't have their faces scanned by police using AI-powered remote biometric ID systems, except for serious crimes like, well, kidnapping or terrorism. The AI Act will take effect 2 years after final approval from European lawmakers, expected in rubber stamp votes early next year. Now, for their part, U.S. regulators' actions so far seem to be having much smaller effects on corporate America. Apple's, they're suspending sales of their Apple Watch pending a potential enforcement of a U.S. International Trade Commission ruling starting December 26th. It's continuing to sell the Apple Watch both online and in stores until the last possible day for Christmas gift buying. And if the ruling happens to go in Apple's direction, which is not by any stretch a sure thing, sales will almost resume immediately. And while a federal jury has found against Google in an important lawsuit brought by Epic Games, the final outcome of that suit remains distant, and few observers expect it to seriously upend the lucrative App Store duopoly of Google and Apple. And at the FTC, two major antitrust efforts, one against Facebook parent Meta, the other against Microsoft, have failed shamefully, raising questions about whether the Biden administration's antitrust approach is backfiring. There, though, the FTC has had some wins. In biotech, Illumina's acquisition of Grail, their manufacturer of gene sequencing machines, was opposed by both the U.S. and the EU. But the U.S. final decision came first, precipitating a formal decision to unwind the deal. The EU has been leading on tech policy and competition policy for a number of years now, and they have a lot more muscle memory and appetite to keep bringing cases and enforcing new laws. At the same time, the U.S. still hasn't been able to pass basic privacy legislation. Now, U.S. courts may be more active than ever on competition and consolidation. But until there are more wins on the board, the EU will continue to lead, with the U.K. also establishing itself as a competition authority to be reckoned with. You know, as 2023 got underway, OpenAI's ChatGPT was barely a month old, and conversations about the impact of AI on the workforce in particular were just beginning. Fast forward to today, almost 12 months later, it's hard not to hear about the ways that generative AI will change how we get our jobs done and how many of those jobs will disappear completely. Among employees, those who use AI at work today say they're more likely to view it as positive, surprisingly, with 72% reporting that it has made them more productive. It's according to the latest CNBC Survey Monkey Workforce Survey. 37% of Gen Zers and 35% of millennials are the most likely to have used AI in their jobs. Just 25% of Gen Xers and 17% of baby boomers report using AI tools like ChatGPT at work. But with use of AI come concerns about the long-term impact on jobs. Despite workers' positive feedback about AI, Almost half, 42% of employees say they're concerned about the technology's impact on their jobs. Among individual contributors, 44% say they're very or somewhat concerned, compared to 38% of managers or people in higher positions. And that speaks to a broader survey finding. The more employees use AI at work, the more concerned they become. 60% of those using AI regularly say they're worried about its impact on their job, compared with just 35% of those who don't use AI at work. And the debate over AI as a job killer is certainly far from settled. Some believe AI will eliminate certain jobs with repetitive, mundane tasks like cashiers and truck drivers. Others, like Elon Musk, believe it will vaporize virtually all jobs. As these companies continue to figure it out, there are those who say employees are operating under some misconceptions. At CNBC's recent Work Summit, social scientist and Harvard University professor Arthur Brooks, who studies happiness, said AI is more likely to disassemble jobs than eliminate them. He observed there are numerous discrete tasks for any job that a person does. AI is going to unbundle those tasks and reassemble them in a way that looks different from the way the job is done today. The collective worry about AI traces back to our fear of change, though, doesn't it? Humans have become wired for change and forward motion. Or as such, employees can view this change as an opportunity for progress, or view it as a tool for career instability. Time will tell if we will lead it or the other way around. Hey, our latest American Survival newsletter has hit the streets once again. Features Melody's weekly market recap. It showed, among other things, gold up another 1.1% and silver up another 3.9% last week. We got Doug Nolan's weekly credit bubble bulletin blog and Wendy Wilson's food for thought. Excuse me, plus I have a piece on inflation. Another week, another drama, you ask? Well, not if you're in the camp of a growing number of mainstream economists and analysts who say the worst is now behind us. One of them, Courtney Brown of Axios, believes that beating inflation, in the U.S. anyway, won't be as hard as we thought as the end of the fight gets closer. Instead, she writes, supply-side rebounds and strong productivity gains have surprised even the best of pundits. Well, you know, the ones who said severe economic pain would be what the doctor ordered to get inflation back to healthy levels. Well, this past summer, Brown reminds us, the Bank for International Settlements warned the last mile of price stability may be the most challenging. That in large part was because of tight labor markets and strong inflation, and especially the services sector. Combination, she says, it might fuel a hard-to-tame wage price spiral. But that script hasn't played out as originally written, at least not in the U.S. And labor markets have chilled, helped by an ample supply of previously unemployed workers who came off the sidelines, and stronger wage gains have gone hand-in-hand with solid productivity growth. And that's been met with cooling inflation. And if forecasts are correct, the PCE price index out on Friday will show it having fallen to 2.8% in the 12 months through November. Excluding volatile food and energy prices, the so-called core PCEs estimated to have slid to about 3.4%. So will the last mile be the hardest? Well, economist Paul Donovan of the Too Big to Fail UBS noted this a few weeks ago. Excuse me, namely that the inflation narrative does not make a great deal of sense. He says there's plenty of evidence that the last mile of inflation is a sprint, not a slog. And director of the White House Council of Economics, Lyle Brainard, said last week that she understood the argument months ago when there's still a lot of murkiness in the data and the inflation trajectory. But she added, I don't get that argument today. She believes we'll continue to see ongoing disinflation and have every reason to anticipate that taking place along with solid growth and good employment. Brainer believes that companies experiencing cheaper input costs from supply chain improvements will pass those along to the consumer, though that remains to be seen. Last week, Fed Chair Jerome Powell said that inflation continues to come down alongside a more balanced job market. He said at his press conference after the FOMC left rates alone, it's so far so good, although we kind of assume that will get harder from here, but so far it hasn't. Well, the Fed and other central bankers certainly want us to believe that. Policymakers almost everywhere warn that the last mile of getting inflation back to 2% will be the most challenging. But with the finish line almost in sight, Brown and her colleague Neil Irwin say disinflation looks to have momentum now to carry through. The report on the other side of the big pond, however, the last mile narrative has stuck. As recently as last month, ECB Executive Board member Isabel Schnabel cautioned that quick wins of the disinflation process were over, adding the disinflation process during the last mile will be much more uncertain, slower, and bumpier. So then, what comes next? As Lisa Abramowitz wonders, she is with Bloomberg Surveillance, the biggest weekly jump in Treasury since the pandemic, the longest streak of the S&P 500 weekly gains since 2017, and a new record high on the NASDAQ 100 is making the Fed, well, deeply uneasy. She writes that as much as they try, however, Fed officials are having a hard time convincing markets that they'll start to cut interest rates sooner than later. New York Fed President Bill Dudley is worried that the market could be getting ahead of itself. He said, I'm worried that the Fed's not going to finish the job. Abramowitz observes that pushback becomes a meaningless phrase if investors keep covering their ears and shouting, we can't hear you, when Fed officials try to temper hopes for sooner rather than later cuts. Steve Chivaroni at Federated Hermes agrees with the potential for communications confusing at the Fed. He says it's difficult when you've got the chair with a very, very dovish message and members of the committee walking it back. But Chivarone thinks that Powell just wants to stick this soft landing, period. And you know what, Chivarone asks? Powell may not be wrong. But Invesco's Matt Brill counters that the data back up Powell's talk, saying overall inflation is on the right path, and they know it. As for when the Fed will start cutting, we'll just have to stay tuned to the newest economic reports coming in early 2024. Again, I think we're going to have to wait at least 2, maybe 3 months to see that first rate cut. As of this morning, the CME's group Fed Watch tool pegs the chance of Fed rate cutting starting on March 20th at 75%. Hey, that's all the time we have for today's program. I'll be back on Thursday. Butch will join Melody tomorrow along with Wendy Wilson of Apothecary Herbs. Thanks as always to our production engineer, Todd Waite, and to you, our loyal listeners, for tuning into Financial Survival. I'm Dave Allen. Please be safe out there. Have a good evening. Bye-bye.